Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Central Asia is rich to festivities. In no doubt, the Independence Day celebration is the mother of all festivals. And this year, the region celebrates its 25 years of independence from the former Soviet Union. As the region marks a milestone today on the Majlis, we look back to find out what was some of the early elements which shaped the region to become what it is today. What were major ups and downs and what happened in between? What were its pivotal moments, personalities and missed opportunities of the past two decades? And how does the future look like? To discuss the subject, I have three personalities who have followed, studied, and lived the region really from the day first. Dr. Grigory Glassin, who is the professor at the Marshall European Center for Security Studies. Dr. Glassin, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Very nice to have you. Dr. Nick Migoran, professor at the University of Newcastle, who taught and lived deep in the region, towns like Osh and Fergana Valley, in its very early days. Dr. Migoran, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you. And my colleague, Bruce Panier. Usually, I introduce him with his official title as the editor of Kishlok Awazi, but today, I step aside to give a full disclosure. I know Bruce from last 13 years, and since then, Central Asia has been, I believe, Bruce, the only subject we discuss in our professional life.
It's the only subject I'm interested in.
Gentlemen, great panel. Thank you very much for joining the Majlis today. There are a lot to talk. We will get to it shortly, but first, let me remind you that please feel free to amplify, expand, or directly disagree with points other guests are making. Please do not wait for me to prompt your questions so that we have a full and lively debate today. With this, Dr. Nick, let me start with you. What is your earliest memories of Central Asia? Take us through your first trip, when it was, where did you go, and what was your first impression?
Yes, well, as a child, it was always a dream of mine to visit Central Asia. I grew up reading stories about the region, and I wasn't there right at the start of independence. I was too young, but in 1995, I first visited in the summer, and I flew to Tashkent to do language study, a course in teaching English as a second language, and then went to Fergana for a year. Hmm. When I landed in Tashkent, it was one of the greatest moments in my life. I'd always wanted to come. And of course, as a youngster, I was probably about 20 at the time, 21. There was a sudden shock that all these people were just getting on with their daily lives. They didn't realize they'd been the object of my fantasies for so many years. And my first visit was, I went to stay with the host family living in a mahalla in Tashkent, and I was taken to a celebration, traditional Uzbek food and great Uzbek hospitality. And of course, Uzbeks will always say, have more, have more, have more. And I thought it was rude to refuse. So I ate more that night than I'd eaten for the previous week. So my first visit to Uzbekistan back in 95 was a memory of great, a dream come true and of great Uzbek hospitality.
Wow. Dr. Greg, where did you end up being in your first trip? What was the objective and how did it go?
Oh, well, if we're reminiscing, we can go back a long way. I did have the same kind of experiences as Nick. There's a tremendous amount of hospitality and warmth, particularly on a person-to-person level in Central Asia. My first interest in Central Asia derived from a dissertation topic that I chose in the 1970s at the University of California when I was interested in Russian, basically Soviet, but we thought of it as Russian foreign policy, and the role that the Central Asian region would have in influencing foreign policy. In particular, this became important with respect to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December of 1979. But I had been working on the topic, and what came as a surprise to me was that at the University of California, Berkeley Library, I found Kommunist Uzbekistana, which was the theoretical journal of the Communist Party of Uzbekistan. And I decided to systematically read through that journal, through about 30 years of that journal, with the intention of identifying the ideological elements that I thought were important. And it came as a big surprise to me that about 70% of the articles were not about Marxist theory, but they were about cotton production. It came as a real surprise. So I moved away from the original objective of my dissertation, and I began focusing on cotton production. And then in 1982, I took my first trip to Tashkent with the intention, financed by cotton interests in the Western world, with the interest of learning about cotton production. And in those days, they wouldn't let me do that because the Uzbeks reasoned that cotton was actually a strategic resource. But they were extremely happy to have me in the country and happy to take me to dinner with them.
What was the reaction of the people whom you interacted? I'm guessing for some of them, at least, it might be the first time, first chance maybe meeting a Westerner.
Well, I think it was the first chance to meet a Westerner outside of a very small number of tourists who traveled to the region. It was open to tourists at that time. But someone who came to the region with an interest in studying their economy and their politics was something that was unusual for them. And it did turn out that cotton was of great importance in the region. And I noticed that just a few days ago, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty reported that Inamjan Usman Khajaev, who was actually tried and put into prison for his role in the so-called cotton scandal, which erupted in 1987, 86 or so, was something that was very important to them. He served as first secretary of the Communist Party from 83 to 88 when he was actually arrested and put in jail. But cotton became a very important topic, and having studied it prior to that, it became a kind of window into the culture and the situation in Uzbekistan. I just want to say I'm very happy that he was exonerated just recently, and he's completely under a complete reprieve, and I think that's a very good turn of events.
Bruce, I think you went there as a young man. What were your imagination before you headed, and what did you end up witnessing?
Well, I studied at Tashkent State in 1990, but you know, in those days it was toward the very end of the Soviet Union, of course, and most of my time was spent on the university, or every now and then I would get to go downtown into Tashkent. I did side trips to Samarkand and Bukhara because, of course, these are the ancient Silk Route cities and just had to see them. But it was kind of limited in scope, one, because I was supposed to be there studying, not so much sightseeing. So it was really 1992 when I arrived and was working for the University of Manchester in cooperation with the Soros organization, which at the time was called the International Fund for Cultural Initiative. That my work was to be out in the villages and see how people had been living in the villages and how the fall of the Soviet Union was changing their lives. And that was kind of a wake-up call. Tashkent was a little more, you know, I'd come from Columbia University, and so it was a little more modest living standards than I'd been quite used to. But when my boss in Manchester hired me, he asked me a lot of questions first about what, you know, had I spent a lot of time outdoors and things, and I told him that I was a backpacker, and he said, good, think that way, exactly. So I went out to the villages, and of course, it was quite a surprise because you'd heard, you know, I'd been studying the Soviet Union, and the images they showed on television shows, Vremya and things, were, you know, this very contemporary, modern country. And I got out into the villages and had to take dirt roads to get out there, and they didn't have electricity and no one had running water, you know. And so this whole image that I had of what the Soviet government had done for all its people and how much they'd raised them up from the old days just kind of fell apart, because in some of those villages I worked in, it looked like no one had taken much care of it, and it could have been hundreds of years ago the way they were living. So it was something of a surprise, but I got used to it. And of course, as Greg and Nick have already mentioned, the hospitality there is absolutely wonderful. So I couldn't have been in better hands. As strange as it was to me at first, people were very, very friendly, and of course, very concerned if they thought that I wasn't getting something and that I might get a bad image of their place. If I got sick, practically the whole village turned out to try to treat me. It was I started to hide being sick because I was afraid of having 60 people who thought they knew medicine showing up and telling me, no, what you need to do is this, what you need to do is that, and here's tea with pepper in it, and here's, you know, something else. And yeah, it was very, very humble kind of living, but absolutely wonderful people, without a doubt.
You know, I'm kind of inclined to go to Nick with the next question that I have, since you lived in Ocean Fergana. Those region must have been very interesting. With collapse of the Soviet Union overnight, villages, towns, even streets separated, ending up in different sides of the border. What was some of the early reaction by the people, and how did they were coping with this new reality after the independence?
Well, yes, no, that's a good question, because after spending a month in Tashkent, I went out for a couple of years to live in the Fergana Valley. I was in Fergana City and then in Osh. The mid-1990s, I remember visiting certain villages and places, and you couldn't tell physically on the landscape where the international boundary was. And I remember trying to look at old maps I'd photocopied and trying to find it. People laughing and saying things like Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan don't matter here. They don't have any relevance. They don't have any meaning. In the mid-90s, you could take a bus. You could fly to Tashkent and take a bus straight to Osh. Bus cross-border bus routes crisscrossed the Fergana Valley. And slowly over time, so it didn't feel in the 1990s like they were different countries. But slowly over time, the presence of nationalism, by which I'm not meaning a negative force, I'm meaning simply the idea that the world is divided into states, independent states demarcated by international boundaries. This idea of nationalism began to imprint itself on the boundaries. So cross-border bus routes were suspended and bridges were demolished and customs and migration checkpoints were introduced and visas were demanded. And slowly the reality of separate countries began to impinge on the landscape of the Fergana Valley and on the consciousness of its inhabitants. And this had a dramatic effect, culminating in what we've been seeing in recent years. In 2008, a bilateral boundary commission was established between Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. And as they have identified where the boundary lay, they've begun to demarcate it. And Uzbekistan in particular has built, erected fences, barbed wire fences, and villages, whole villages where I spent great amounts of time no longer exist now. They have been demolished. And in this process, it happened in accordance with law. People were given compensation often. They were given the possibility of moving, but it has transformed the understanding of the borderlands. It felt in the past, when I first went there 20 years ago, that Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan were more theoretical realities, but now they are very much everyday realities. So the children of the friends I first made at that time have grown up, some of them never having crossed the boundary, whereas their parents crisscrossed it, sometimes seasonally for work or study, often daily to see families. So the sense that the Fergana Valley was an international, multi-ethnic space has been dramatically changed with the imposition of these boundaries. So that has been the largest and most significant change that I've seen and experienced in my lifetime and in the experiences of my friends living in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, the days when you would cross the Uzbek-Turkmen border without even requiring to show a piece of paper is unfortunately over long, long time ago. So what was some of the early steps those countries have taken as an independent nation? I guess restricting border was one of them.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of changed from place to place. Uzbekistan, just because it's in the center, I kept having to go through Uzbekistan to get back and forth across Central Asia. I was working in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. The Tajik Civil War kept us from working there. But Uzbekistan was the first one to actually start to consider some kind of customs check or border check when you entered their territory. And at first it could be something as simple as basically a card table with a couple guys sitting in fold-out chairs, and they would stop cars and ask you a couple questions and maybe look at your passport. And that was it. On the Turkmen border, I can remember that I always took the train from Tashkent to Ashgabat. And the first couple times I did, no one even bothered to check at all. But after a little while, when we got to then Charjoy, which is now Turkmenabad, the Uzbek border guards would get on about one or two stops before that and go through the train and check everybody. And then you would get to Turkmenabad, Charjoy, and the Turkmen border guards would get on and they would be there until you got to Bayram Ali or some of those places. And it was really friendly. It shows how much things have changed, because I can remember the Turkmen border guards I always had, because it was about a 24-hour trip from Tashkent to Ashgabat. I always had one of the sleeping cabinets, which there's four beds in there, and there was four people in there. And every time they got to my cabin, they would see my American passport, and they would just sit down and talk for like an hour with me. They had all kinds of questions about America, and they were the friendliest people in the world, extremely curious. What's America like? You know, millions and millions of questions, it seemed like. And one of the funniest things that I remember, that was one of the there was like three Turkmen border guards in my cabin talking to me. And the one finally said, why are you on a train? He said, Americans don't take trains. And he stood up and made this motion with his hands out and said, Americans fly, you know. And I thought that was hysterical, but it shows how different it was, because by the end of 1993, which was the last time I was able to get into Turkmenistan, they were very, very serious about, you know, who was I? Why was I there? Why didn't I have a proper Turkmen visa? You know, where was I going? Who was I talking to? Where had I been when I'd been there previously? And Uzbekistan was the same way for me anyway, by the end of 1993, where the novelty of me being a foreigner had entirely worn off, and they were very suspicious about why I was out there. And of course, when I had studied at Tashkent State, I was studying Uzbek language. So this was another thing that confused them. Like, why do you speak Uzbek? And the answer that because I'm in Uzbekistan was not sufficient. You know, they figured that the only reason any foreigner, specifically an American, would know their language was because he was a spy. And they told me exactly that. So things changed.
Bruce, could I ask you a question, Bruce?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you experience any dissonance in the minds of officials? Because on the one hand, there is a tension, I think, between the Central Asian hospitality. You are a guest, a mehmon. And on the other hand, the demands of the role of an official to interrogate and check and police. Did you ever find that individuals during this period that you're discussing experienced a dissonance in their dealings with you and a tension?
Yeah, I mean, they would talk to me very sternly, but at the same time, they would offer me clove and tea, you know, so it was kind of like the hospitality was still there, but the friendly conversation wasn't quite so friendly. And again, it changed from place to place. In Turkmenistan, for instance, just by pure chance, I hooked up with people who were part of Oxy Birlik. One of the people I was working with was from there. So that cast a lot of doubt on what my true purpose was in being in Turkmenistan. But I think in the Uzbek case, they were just more concerned that I kept popping up in places all over the country and entering and exiting from all over the place. So it was obvious that their superiors had heard about me and wanted them to discover what my purpose was in being there. And like I said, they just doubted that I could possibly just be a graduate student who was doing sociological research in their country. They suspected some other motive behind what I was doing. So while they were very happy to meet me and absolutely unfamiliar with Americans, at that time, there was also I could see that they were being pressured to make sure that I was not up to no good, so to speak. And you know, and I was accused a couple times of actually being a spy. And when I pointed out I'm working on the farm, and what am I spying on? How many sheep you got, and how many apricots grow on your trees? And I certainly didn't blend in with the population, you know. But there was a lot of doubt, and I think some of that was from the Soviet propaganda that they'd been exposed to for so long, where America was the enemy and evil intentions and all that kind of stuff.
Now we are already talking about the second stage of Central Asia, from nostalgia towards outside world to some level of suspicion. Dr. Greg, where this suspicion started, where this nostalgia ended about, let's say, about the democratic world, Western world?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It certainly, the atmosphere, the character of interactions, particularly with officials, has changed over the years. But I'm struck by the importance of the comments that Nick made with respect to the borders themselves and the roles that borders play in national consciousness. I want to mention that I'm just speaking as a scholar and not representing my institution, but I do want to point out that from my perspective, the borders historically don't play the same role that they played in, say, European countries or some other countries, some other parts of the world, because those borders did not exist historically. They were very much the creation of the Committee on Razmezhivanie that in 1924, when the Soviet Union formally was being adopted with the Treaty of Union of the Soviet Union, those divisions were made by people who had some information about the cultures of the region and the territory of the region, the lie of the land, so to speak, but not a great deal of information about that. So they were made, I think, as a kind of compromise to create national structures, very different pattern than what we see in countries like Poland and France, where there's first a nation and the nation goes looking for a state, basically. In this case, the states, it seems to me, were fairly arbitrarily drawn, and of course the most important aspect of that is in the Ferghana Valley, which is divided among states, and the entrance to the Dox Canyon of the huge and very productive valley is controlled by Tajikistan territory. A very unusual set of circumstances that led to the building the road over the Angren Pass and then the tunnel that has recently been opened through Angren. And it seems to me that these borders seem to me to be artificial creations that have been brought into life but don't make a great deal of rational sense given the economy and the lie of the land of the region.
I think with this division of border, we also seen kind of increasing division among the Central Asian leaders. You would imagine that they are coming from the same background as a Communist Party member. But after the independence, you have seen disagreement, difference of direction between them. And there was a point when some of them, at least, would not even communicate to each other. So what went wrong there, Bruce?
Well, now, this is going to be obviously there was we had five different leaders who were all educated in the Soviet Union, and they had to make some important choices very, very quickly after the Soviet Union collapsed. And let's remember that I suppose with the possible exception of Askar Akayev in Kyrgyzstan, none of these other leaders really wanted to leave the Soviet Union, or they certainly weren't anxious. Now many of them are portrayed as having led their country to independence and stuff, but I remember the way it was at the time, and people like Islam Karimov and Saparmurat Niyazov did not want to leave the Soviet Union. And I think it says a lot about Kazakhstan that they were the last to declare independence. I don't know whether that was that they distrusted what had happened in Moscow was really the final word or what happened. But anyway, so you have five different people who really weren't trained to actually lead a country, but were trained to take orders. And now they're all of a sudden they are the heads of an independent country. Like I said, they had to make some important decisions, and they had to make them really quick because people were getting anxious. You know, and I showed up in March 1992, and everyone was very confused about the way the situation was. One thing I think that contributed to the evolution of events in Central Asia the way they are now was Islam Karimov, once he managed to get a little bit comfortable in power in Uzbekistan. If you looked at the history of Central Asia going up to the time when the Russians arrived, it had been divided into Khanates and Emirates, which were essentially dominated by ethnic Uzbeks at that time for the couple hundred years previous to when the Russians had arrived. And I think Karimov was the first one to perceive his nation as that, as being a nation. And not only that, but since the Uzbeks were the most numerous peoples in Central Asia, he got a vision of Uzbekistan as being the regional power. And it kind of immediately changed the dynamics of the relationship between the other countries. I remember even in late 1992, one of the shows they always had on TV, it seemed like when I went to Uzbekistan, was something to do with the military and how Uzbekistan was building up this big military. And it was clear where this was going, that they were going to be the regional policemen, and they were also going to dictate some of the terms. At the time, Uzbekistan was probably the economic power, largely due to the fact that the Soviet Union had dumped a large amount of money into Uzbekistan for the Afghan campaign, because that was the doorway to Afghanistan. So it looked like Uzbekistan might even top Kazakhstan at that time and become not only the military power, but the economic power of Central Asia. And from there, everything, like I said, just seemed to fall apart. Tajikistan fell into civil war, and Uzbekistan decided that they were going to play a role in that and keep the Islamic elements in the opposition out and prop up Rahman. He bullied Askar Akayev in Kyrgyzstan and was extremely displeased when the Kyrgyz introduced their own currency in May 1993, because I was out there, so I saw that all of a sudden Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan became the dumping ground for rubles, and so Karimov was unhappy about that, and Niyazov was just kind of a hard character to get along with. So him and Karimov, Niyazov was eccentric and Karimov was a little bit more pragmatic about things, and they didn't get along. They had a bad personal relationship, and the worse things got, the more Uzbekistan kept trying to demonstrate that it was the power in Central Asia, and like I said, it just you know, from there, there it was very hard to get anything that looked like regional cooperation going again. And I think that's still true to this day, although we have a new president and he's saying something different. But the reality on the ground today is in large part a reflection of Islam Karimov's early policies in the 1990s in Uzbekistan.
In terms of
Mohammed, could I raise a question with respect to Bruce's
sure.
view of Uzbekistan as being the powerhouse, so to speak, in Central Asia during that early period? I mean, before petroleum emerged in the region as a real determiner of who had the money to exert influence. But during that early period, I mean, one of the things that strikes me about Islam Karimov is that despite the fact that he had this representation, this profile of being the most powerful leader of the largest country in a country that's located physically right in the center of Central Asia and has influence to has a border with every other Central Asian country, which no other Central Asian country does. One of the things that strikes me and he did finance in November of 1994. He did finance Rahmon. There's no question about that. And he also did finance in the northern part of Tajikistan in 1997, 98, and early 99, probably the breakaway movement in northern Tajikistan. But one of the things that Islam Karimov did not do that I think is historically important is that he did not try to change any of the borders in Central Asia. Bruce, don't you think that's a significant kind of breaking point that they would not cross during that period?
No, I would totally agree. I mean, I was kind of surprised too. You know, even Uzbekistan, they did make some very, very small attempts at moving the border post to try to gain more agriculturally viable land. You know, that I can remember a couple times they got caught. Border guards got caught moving fence posts, you know, 4 or 5 kilometers deep into Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan or something like that. But you're right. That seemed to be one of the things where, I don't know, familiarity with the maps from the Soviet period or something, but that was one inviolable aspect to their even poor relations, was that no one was willing to go so far as to try to make a claim on land or invade part of the territory, which now that you mentioned it is pretty surprising, because Uzbekistan certainly could have done that if they'd wanted to in the early days. You know, possibly they were still worried about the Russian factor in there. Uzbekistan had kicked out the Russian troops just about as fast as they could and ordered all the ethnic Uzbeks serving abroad in the Soviet Union to return and take up military duty there. But other countries in the region did not do that. Immediately, Russian border guards were in Kyrgyzstan until the late 1990s. They were on the Afghan border in Tajikistan until 2004, 2005. They were in Turkmenistan until 1994, I think. So that might have also had some role to it, where if you had actually tried to mess with the borders, even though we now look back and see the Russian government at that time under Yeltsin as being very weak, the Central Asians still, you know, certainly in the early days, first couple of years of independence, weren't sure that Russia wasn't going to one day recover and then say, okay, well, you're still all part of our country and we're still the rulers of whatever you want to call it, the former Soviet Union, Russian Turkestan, something like that. So I think that might have also had a little bit of a role in that, where they weren't sure that by doing something to take over part of the land, they might prompt a Russian reaction and a return of the Russian military.
Coming back to some of the really, really local issues of early days of independence, I remember Turkmenistan facing enormous shortage of flour, food stock of various type. Even a Russian hat, which was famous among communist elite, went missing from the market. So that was one of the most valuable gifts you could bring if you happened to be visiting Moscow those days. So what was some of the earliest challenges of those countries domestically talking about, and how did they evolve over the time? Who wants to take this question?
Well, in terms of the earliest challenges, of course, as the Soviet system disintegrated, the lines of communication and transportation also fell apart. And so many areas of, for instance, the eastern part of Tajikistan, parts of Kyrgyzstan, the Narin Oblast, these were areas that had no real connection to outside markets. And so I think anybody who was there during the period of the early 1990s saw a lot of near starvation, actually, and people thrust into really desperate situations in rural areas, not so much in the urban areas, which did face economic hardship without any question, but not the level of some of the more remote areas. So that was a very disruptive period. It was a consequence not of the structural adaptation that had to take place, but a consequence of the way that the Soviet Union was administratively structured in a hierarchy with single suppliers of goods and services that were distributed and allocated on the basis of political criteria rather than economic criteria. So that transition was very difficult. And, you know, when I think about the big picture of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the emergence of these countries, it seems to me that we in the West, in particular, were oftentimes moving from a kind of unjustified and unchallenged assumption that the countries were in what we called transition. And in the Russian language, of course, they use the same language, the Perekhod, as though it was a transition from the Soviet system into a model that would be very much like England or France or any other Western country, when in fact that was not the trajectory at all. That was not the way that the events and the trends in the region pushed the countries. So I think we were starting from unchallenged and really not very sturdy assumptions during that period.
Again, talking about some of those local challenges and how some of the regional powers benefited from that, in case of Turkmenistan, you have seen Iran playing huge role by providing flour and Turkey penetrating in all aspects of the society. But we haven't seen a West in the region. What was going on in the Western minds those days, Dr. Nick?
Actually, I think Bruce was probably the best to comment on that with his journalistic activities in that period. I'll maybe let him answer that first.
Okay. I hate to compare Western policy in the early 1990s to Chinese policy at the end of the last decade, you know, 2008, 2009. But most of what I saw when I was there in the early 90s, the interest on the part of the West was resources. And that's the almost the only Westerners I ever met in 1992, 3, 4, 5, 6, when I would go traveling through those regions, from Newmont Mining, Chevron, you know, on and on and on. But it was always oil or gold or something like that. I didn't, you know, very rarely. I remember running into one guy who wanted to start a cattle ranch in Kazakhstan. But he was absolutely the exception. I think most people in the West, they hadn't even heard of these places. You know, and I can vouch for that. Growing up as a kid in America, when we talked about the Soviet Union, we use the term Russia. So all of a sudden, these new countries appear: Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and no one was familiar with those names. No one knew what was there for the most part. So the only interest in the initial years of independence was really resources. So people had heard there was oil or natural gas or some mining interests or something like that out there, but no one really made a push to go in and see if they could enter the business world at that time. So there just wasn't that kind of interest, I suppose, on the part of Western governments. It was purely almost purely resource.
Dr. Nick, anything to add?
The beginning of that period, though, there were by the mid 1990s. I forget the exact date, but NATO had formed some. Bruce can probably remember this better, but had formed some initial partnership agreements. So I would occasionally meet NATO soldiers in Fergana around that time, for example. So there was the development of some what would later be called security issues. But of course, it was the September the 11th attacks in the United States that changed substantially the nature of those relationships, when Central Asia suddenly became seen as the front line in the war on terror. So those were very significant periods as well.
Dr. Greg, would you say that was a missed opportunity from Western perspective?
I think it's a very important question, Mohammed, and I think I can answer, at least from my personal perspective, no, it was not a missed opportunity. The reason I think that is because there wasn't really, in terms of economic exchange, in terms of cultural exchange, there wasn't much to be gained from large countries like the United States or Canada
outside of primary commodities, outside of energy commodities, gas and oil, and perhaps some minerals, and perhaps agriculture. Outside of that, there were a few folklore items, but nothing else that could be traded with country far away like the United States that would be beneficial to the United States. So the United States historically, and I think presently, is not a country that seeks spheres of influence and an effort to control foreign regions. There are American financial commercial interests and business in other countries, but in terms of a sphere of influence, it's just not something that comes into the American thinking. That is very different than the thinking of the Kremlin, very much expressed in the last decade. It was articulated, I think, in explicit form in 1993 by Andrei Kozyrev, who talked about the border of the Soviet Union being the limit of Russia's sphere of influence. And that has continued to, it seems to me, inform thinking in the Kremlin about what their area responsibilities are. They think of Tajikistan as a country that they have to protect and defend and then use for resources for their benefit. That was never the thinking in Western capitals. It certainly wasn't the thinking in the United States. So I don't think it was a missed opportunity. I think that it was a realistic way to look at a country in Central Asia, far away from the United States, it would never become a trading partner, and also wasn't on a development trajectory that would be something like the European countries, the so-called Washington consensus about what to expect in developing countries. So I don't think it was a missed opportunity. There was quite a bit of humanitarian assistance that went to the region during those early days of the 1990s, but there was no real political effort nor security effort to have a permanent presence in the region to control the market for American car manufacturers or anything along those lines. And I agree with the others who mentioned that September 11th changed Central Asia's role in American foreign policy because of the importance of Afghanistan.
Definitely. We will talk about that. It's been really interesting discussion. We will continue our discussion about the shifting picture of the region. It is pivotal moments, personalities who left a lasting impact shortly.